session number 27075, reel 10.
Squadron Reader Leggett, reel 10. You were just telling me that you'd then joined your first operational squadron at Prestwick. What number squadron was that?
That was 615 Squadron. I arrived there on the 26th of March 1940, and on the 27th of March 1940 boarded an aircraft for Aldergrove, Northern Ireland, having learned that my posting was a mistake and I was supposed to be the number 245 Squadron in Aldergrove. Whereupon I was poured into a Whitley, I do believe, and to my astonishment flown across to Northern Ireland by one Alan Frampton, who I was at school with. Small world.
Had he gone into the RAF prior to the war, or was he the same as yourself? Had he done the role?
Yes, he was a couple of years older than me, and he was on a short service commission, having recently joined, or at least having joined before the war broke out. At Aldergrove, I was greeted by the pilots, many of whom had recently returned from France. And embarked on some intensive flying in hurricanes, primarily to gear me up for operations further south. The squadron itself was going to remain in Aldergrove for some little time.
Could you tell me a little bit about the squadron, its kind of organisation and its history?
You mean 245 particularly?
Yeah.
Well, the organisation of a fighter squadron is fairly straightforward. At the top, you have a commanding officer, squadron leader. In this case, one Eric Whitley, charming man. He then has two flight commanders, flight lieutenants. Flight Lieutenant, now, what was their names? Right on the tip of my tongue, but of course they won't come. However, Don Stone, no, not Don, Flight Lieutenant Stones was one flight commander. I was in his flight. And the other was Flight Lieutenant Emmett. And Emmett used to love taking me up. He'd say, let's go and have a tail chase. And so up we'd go. And he whizzed me all around the sky, and he really made it tough for me to hang onto his tail, and even tougher for me to shake him off my tail. And so that lasted a couple of weeks. Sad to say, during that time, a very good friend from Cambridge days was coming to land, or at least, no, he'd just taken off in his Hurricane when he developed a glycol leak. This is something we encountered all too often with hurricanes. It occurred when the gasket joining the cylinder head to the block became unserviceable, and the glycol, inflammable liquid, flow into the cylinders and ignite, and in no time at all you've got a sheet of flame coming out of the exhaust pipes. And on this occasion, Suffy Beedon just got airborne when this thing happened, and all the white smoke came pouring out of the exhaust pipes. He was still over the airfield, and therefore I suppose justifiably tried to get back into it. Although the rules always were and always are, there was engine failure on takeoff. The last thing you do is turn back, you keep going and trying to plop it down wherever. However, Snuffy decided to try and get it down, went round the circuit, left-hand circuit, and almost made it. He was coming in on his final approach, but he got enveloped in all this glycol smoke and flame, and the aircraft just flicked, got it too slow, and the aircraft stalled, flicked over, and crashed on the perimeter, on the terrier track. And of course, he was killed. That was my first encounter with what can happen in the flying game. However, after a couple of weeks to Aldergrove, I was posted to number 46 squadron, then based at the satellite to North Weald, North Weald being an operational station to the northeast of London, and the satellite airfield place called Stapleford Abbots, which during the before the war was operated by a small company specialising flights to the Channel Islands. 46 was the only squadron on this grass airfield, quite small. The facilities were fairly basic, comprising the flying clubhouse and amenities. There was no accommodation on the airfield, and all the pilots were billeted out in houses dotted round about.
Would that be with families you were
posted? Yes, I was with a family, Watsons, I think their name was. But I saw little of them because we still had lots of daylight and we'd be up very early in the morning. We'd be on readiness, I would imagine, by 6 o'clock, if not earlier. Though the routine was that we'd foregather in the mess at breakfast. But ready to go, there'd be a vehicle standing outside the door, and if we got a scramble, we could go straight up from breakfast, as we did once or twice. Now, this time, the Luftwaffe had decided that there was no future in mass daylight bombing raids, and undoubtedly Hitler had ideas about going for Russia, so he called off the mass daylight bomber raids on England. In its place, he put on a night blitz, principally on London and some of the Liverpool and Manchester, and at the same time went in for a policy of formations of 12 to 15 Messerschmitt 109s, many of them carrying a single bomb, 250 or perhaps 500 pound bomb, and sending these formations over very high, at least 30,000 feet, and they'd come across, drop their bombs almost anywhere, and then turn around and scurry off for home, hoping on the way back that they'd pick off an RAF aircraft that was a bit unwary at the time. And on my, I think it was on my second or third scramble, encountered one of these formations. We were, at the time, the policy was that Hurricanes would operate at about 15,000 feet, and in the absence of any particular incoming raid, we'd be simply put onto the patrol line, usually the Maidstone patrol line. With the object of intercepting any bomber raids that did happen to come through. We didn't know at that time, of course, that the mass bomber raids had been called off. They just weren't appearing anymore. We would fly in a formation laid down by the Air Ministry, a tight formation of 12 aircraft in VICS of 3 aircraft lying astern. We'd climb up in that formation onto the patrol line, whereupon the two tail aircraft would climb up and watch our tails from 2,000 or 3,000 feet above. And we relied on them to give warning of attack. And that's exactly what happened on my, I think it was my third sortie. And we've been on the patrol line for 10, 15 minutes when the controller announced that there were enemy aircraft in the vicinity. And at that moment, one of our formation called that he had aircraft above, 12 o'clock. At the same moment, one of our tail-end Charlies, as we call them, who were weaving behind, keeping an eye out for attacks of this kind, called that there were snappers astern. Snappers was the code word for enemy fighters. And they dived down on us, the squadron commander, the squadron leader, I think at the time, was Rivaliati. I think he was leading that day, one of the flight commanders. And he called break, which meant that we had to pull the aircraft across very, very tight into a tight turn, either left or right, whichever he said. If the enemy were coming in from the port side, he would yell, break port, so that we would turn into the oncoming attack. Or alternatively, of course, break starboard if they're on the other side. And so he called break, and we all immediately broke the formation and went into tight turns to port. And it was not a very comfortable thing because I hadn't really got my oxygen mask or mouthpiece properly tightened. And putting on the G-force, immediately the oxygen mask pulled away from my face. My goggles, which weren't down, I had them up on my forehead, they pulled down over my eyes. And it was all a bit hectic. And we were all milling around in tight turns. And the next thing I saw was an aircraft going down in flames. Couldn't see who or what it was. It was just an aircraft going down in flames. And after a bit of this, the squadron commander called reform, which we did, and carried on the patrol until we were told by control to pancake, which was return to base and land. So that was my first encounter with frontline warfare. Exciting enough. I think in many ways, because of the exercises we've been doing in the pre-operational squadrons, I don't think it was came as a great surprise just how it all panned out. What I wanted to know more than anything, well, what's one supposed to do about it? And of course the answer is get onto the tail of an enemy aircraft and shoot him down. It was theoretically as simple as that, and very often people indeed do just that many times.
Which was the aircraft that was shot down? Was it a German one or one of yours?
It was, in fact, one of ours. I must confess, I can't remember the fellow's name. But, he bailed out, that's right, he bailed out, because when we got back to the airfield, Stapleford, he rang through, or at least the army rang through, to say that he was all right, that his aircraft obviously crashed. But he bailed out, they picked him up, and he was all right. I think he had a few burns, but nothing serious.
How long had the whole combat taken, really, time-wise?
Yes, it seemed like several hours. In fact, I dare say it was several seconds. Very, very brief. This is the way it was. The dogfighting in 1914-18, I believe, could go on more or less indefinitely, because speeds were much lower and everybody was much closer to each other all the time. Here in 1940, though, we were travelling at considerable speed, and one could be one could outdistance oneself from another aeroplane in a matter of seconds. So yes, contacts of this kind were very brief. Earlier on, of course, when the big bomber raids were coming in, and they were coming streaming in vast formations, and the combat would last as long as the ammunition lasted, which wasn't very long, 15 seconds to be precise. When the ammunition had been used up, there was nothing else to do but go home. There was a case of the Pole who decided he'd prefer to ram the enemy aircraft, which he did, but it was all quite brief.
And how long were the duration of your patrols?
We'd usually be on patrol line for an hour. The average sortie was about 1 hour 15, 1 hour 20 minutes. Convoy patrols would tend to be somewhat longer, sometimes an hour and a half, hour and three quarters. But we'd always reckon to be home within 2 hours.
And obviously, if you were involved in air combat, would you have a limited amount of fuel at that period? Would that be used up very, very quickly during combat as opposed to patrolling?
Yes. Yes, on the patrol, you'd throttle back. More for cohesion than anything. It was always easier to hold a formation together. Lost myself.
We were talking about fuel.
Oh yes, yes, yes. So going up and down, stooging up and down a convoy line of ships. We'd be throttled back a bit so that the fuel consumption would be there. But of course, once you got into a combat, you tended to jam the throttle wide open. In fact, once or twice I pulled the plug. This is a little knob down the left-hand side of the instrument panel, painted red. And the Merlin engine was governed so that it would not be used excessively for an excessively long time. But in combat, sometimes it was necessary to pull this plug, which overrode this particular control on the engine, and it gave you that little bit of extra power, but you had to be discreet about it and not use it for too long. I must confess, it was rather easy to forget sometimes that you had pulled it. And so realizing it suddenly and bang it home, hoping that no damage had been done. And with the plug pulled, of course, your fuel consumption would be that much higher. Yeah. We could, in fact, although it didn't occur during operations in this country, but the Hurricane could be fitted with overload tanks, long-range tanks. And these carried, I think they carried 40 gallons of fuel each, if I remember rightly. So you had two extra, you had another 80 gallons, which did make quite a difference to the time one could stay airborne. But they were not They were not satisfactory for operational purposes. They did restrict the manoeuvrability of the aircraft, made it more difficult to handle. And of course, they were fairly bulky and would reduce the speed that the aircraft could fly.
Would you, obviously during this period, would you be patrolling daily, or how many times a day?
Yes, once, twice a day, yeah. I think we'll find IS 245 is gone, that's right. Eric Whitley, he was the CEO. I was on the second sortie, in fact. We engaged 2109s. The entry says patrol stable for which was our airfield. Engaged 20 ME-109s, and the same thing happened the following day.
How long would they have over southern England?
Oh, not very long. I would say about 10-15 minutes. If they're over London, shall we say, if they were escorting to London, they got about 10 or 15 minutes over the target, if that. And it was a part of the plan of things, that we knew they'd be turning around and going back before long. To my knowledge, they didn't have long-range tanks on the 109s at all.
You mentioned that they were carrying bombs to attack targets. At that stage, what targets were they aiming for?
No, they weren't. The object was simply to make sure that we went up to get at them. They were a bit of bait, that was all.
So there was no real reason to carry
them? No. It may be fair to say that they would go as far as what would look like an industrial area, shall we say, possibly. But they were very high, you see. They were at least 20,000, very often 30,000 feet. So they couldn't see very much on the ground. No, it was more often than not, they'd just come whizzing over. They probably only intended to stay 10 or 15 minutes in the hope of picking off a few Hurricanes or Spitfires while they were over. And they just let the bombs go at random. Certainly, the moment we got into conflict, they'd all let them go.
At that point as well, were German fighter aircraft? I mean, obviously, there are incidents that are recorded of them attacking civilian targets, machine gunning buses and that sort of thing. Was there any instances of that sort of thing at that stage? There any instances where the German aircraft would attack civilian targets?
Oh, not specifically. No, I don't think. Not deliberately. Though having said that, it could be said they were deliberately attacking the civilian population by just dropping bombs on built-up areas at random, and that was not difficult. They only had to come to London and pull the lever, and they were going to hit something. So to that extent, yes, they were waging war on the civilian population. In fact, my wife, who was in the South London area, Camberwell, at that time at school. And she says that a German aircraft, she didn't know what it was, but the German aircraft flew low past the school. There was a machine gunner in the back firing his gun. That obviously was a Stuka JU-87. Or it might have been a 110. And so, yes, he was having a go at civilians, no doubt about that. But I don't think that happened very often.
Certainly not something that you encountered at all.
No.
And while you were flying the patrols, would you fly the same Hurricane?
Well, very often. The three sorties in a row in the same one, then two, then one. Then one, two, three, four, five on the same aircraft there. I think probably what tended to happen, the new boys We'd be given the roughest, tattiest home machine on the outfit. And if they broke it, it wouldn't matter too much. But, yes, and after that, undoubtedly, the senior members of the squadron, they'll have their own aircraft for as long as it's possible. They might lose it one way or another, or, of course, it might have to go in for servicing.
Because, obviously, there's sometimes you do see examples of personalised aircraft. Was there any examples of that in the 46 squadron?
Yes. No, I didn't. Not all the time I was flying. Yes, there was only one chap I know, apart from squadron flight commanders, they made sure they had their own aircraft. Yes, one chap in Malta, Chips Carpenter, he had his own aeroplane. He called it Cherche la Femme. And he flew that whenever he possibly could. But no, most of us got what we were given. But I think, generally speaking, when the flight commander was making up the board for the day, he probably did attempt to keep you on the same aircraft. Obviously, it was a good thing to do so, because you had the feel of it more.
Hmm. And at this stage, could I just ask you what flying gear you were wearing?
Flying gear, yes.
What you would wear?
Yes, well, this was October, you see, October 1940. I'd been wearing my ordinary uniform, tunic, trousers, service shirt. Now, we didn't wear ties, because if you went in the drink with a tie on, it wasn't a good idea. So we discarded ties and had a scarf of some kind in its place. In fact, I still got mine upstairs somewhere. And then flying boots, fur-lined flying boots. And a May West. Now, as the winter set in, of course, it got colder. We wore our fur-lined flying jackets, and they were good. They really kept you warm. We did, in fact, have fur-lined trousers, but we never bothered with those. The bomber crews used to wear them, so going on these long trips in a cold aeroplane. But not many of us bothered with those. So it was usually a uniform, flying jacket, and a May West over the top.
Did anybody ever fly in shoes at all? Just in
ordinary shoes. They may well have done, but I think they're a bit unwise, because the extremities did tend to get very cold. We had gauntlet gloves, leather gauntlet gloves, and inside those we wore little silk, white silk gloves. Because it did get cold. Even at 15,000 feet on the patrol line, it was quite cold. People flying higher, the Spit Boys, were usually flying a good deal higher than we were. I'm pretty sure they needed to wrap up pretty warm.